What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the Primal King Podcast. This is episode number 104. That's right, episode 104. All right, so there's kind of been a lot of craziness coming on, and I feel like the past couple of weeks have been a little bit heavy because we've been dealing with kind of like mandates and stuff like that. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to just have kind of a fun episode talking about some hunting. If you're listening to this kind of as they come out, it is hunting season. We're right in the middle of archery elk season here in the great state of Idaho. And so what better way to get away from some of the nonsense going on than just talk about some good old hunting, right? It's the Primal King Podcast. Of course, we endorse hunting, knowing where your meat comes from, where your food comes from. And so, again, just wanted to have a little bit of fun with a friend of mine, a virtual friend of mine. We've known each other for a couple of years, never met in person. But hey, that's the way the world works now, right? So I know you guys are going to love this episode. Just some fun hunting stories, get to talk about some of that stuff. So I know, again, this is going to be a good, lighthearted, fun episode. Also, one thing that is happening today is that we are releasing our pork. That's right. Crosso Meats has now finally gotten to the point to where we can get you out the most amazing pork. Guys, it's a heritage breed. It's got like Mangalitsa and all these other craziness. It's been like specifically bred over a 35-year period to be like look at it this way. If you could take pork and then like cook it in a pound of butter, but not actually have to add the butter because the pork is just that good and that juicy and that flavorful. Listen, like you got to try it out. It is phenomenal. Been very selfish, been eating it myself for like a week because, of course, I've got to test it out before I can get it to you guys. So make sure you go to crossomeats.com. If you're not signed up for the email, you're just not going to know when this stuff happens. So you got to go on there, make sure you're subscribed. Lastly, one great thing that goes with your breakfast sausage is going to be some coffee. So go to blackriflecoffee.com, put in the promo code Primal King, save yourself 20%. You might as well have some coffee with your breakfast sausage and everything else. So make sure blackriflecoffee.com, enter promo code Primal King. All right, let's get started. So the question is this: how do we live the best life that we can with the limited amount of time that we get to be here? Is it by accumulating success and fame and fortune and everything else that society tells us that we need in order to be fulfilled? Or is it much more simple than that? My name is Derek Wilson. I'm the host of the Primal King Podcast, and we're going to be answering this as well as many other questions as we move forward. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Primal King Podcast. I am super fired up for my guest today. When the world seems to be going a little crazy, I wanted to take a step back and have some fun talking about hunting. My guest is someone who grew up in the outdoors and fell in love with the lifestyle from a very early age. He is the club events manager for the Cabela's and Bass Pro Shop's signature events. He's been able to go all around the world hunting all kinds of different animals, as well as being able to document and tell the stories that go along with the experience. He's a great guy and a family man that truly knows what is important. He's also a Nebraska football fan, but we won't tease him about that right now. I'd like to welcome on Mr. Adam Bender. Again, Adam, thanks for coming on.
Hey, no problem, man. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So I just wanted to, because I see you on social media and I know you're able to travel all over the place, not just around the country, but literally around the world. What, I guess, maybe kind of got you to that point? I know that you grew up hunting, but was it something to where you thought, hey, someday I want to make my kind of my living hunting? Or what kind of started that? Have you always just been into it, or what was it like growing up?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a family that, you know, hunting, fishing, camping was all we did. I mean, my free time as a youngster was at my dad's side. Hunting, fishing was just a way of life for us. You know, naturally, I think any kid that grows up doing that, they want to figure out, you know, how do I have a hunting TV show someday? You know, I want to get paid to hunt. Which it's interesting that actually did happen at one point in my life. But no, you know, I went to college and I thought, all right, I'm going to be a game warden. That's what I'm going to do. So I went to University of Nebraska, started in fisheries and wildlife, and I got about a year in and I went, man, if I'm going to be a game warden, I'm going to be working when everybody is out hunting, fishing. So I'm not going to be able to hunt and fish as much. So I kind of wised up to how that was going to work. And then I kind of did a complete 180. I fell in love with photography and writing. I'd always loved to write. So I changed majors to journalism and mass communications, and complete opposite end of the spectrum. And I actually graduated with a bachelor's in journalism, mass communications with a double major in history. And I was a day away from taking a job in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, right outside Albuquerque, I was a day away from taking a job as a sports writer photographer for a weekly newspaper. And I got a call from Cabela's. They basically were looking to fill a position. My resume got somewhere, et cetera. And they said, hey, we heard you like to hunt and fish and you know how to write and take your own pictures. I said, yeah. So went out there for an interview, still had all my stuff packed up because I was getting ready to accept this job. Went out on a Wednesday. They offered me the job on Thursday. I moved on Friday and I started with Cabela's right out of college as a copywriter. And so basically what I did was I wrote all of the descriptions when you opened up the magazine or you had the internet, whatever. And, you know, it was a pair of socks to a pair of boots, waders, whatever, all that descriptive copy that was written by a team there. And I was on that team from 2007 to 2010. And then I actually moved up to Powell, Wyoming, took a different job with Eastman's Hunting Journals. And when I was up there, I was responsible for their digital media. It then evolved into their magazine. And that's where I actually got that childhood dream. And I was on a few of the Eastman's Hunting TV episodes and had a daughter in 2013. And as you know, kids change everything. And I wanted to get back home and be able to give my kids, growing up next to grandma and grandpa like I did. So I was 17 hours away, right up Powell's a little town right northeast of Cody. And 17 hours away, I just wasn't going to cut it from grandma and grandpa, as I found out. So moved back home, got a job with Club, and basically been doing the Signature Outdoor Adventures and the Experience program ever since.
So I got to ask, if you're a sports writer in New Mexico, what do you cover?
That's a great question. I don't know. Never took the job, but it was a weekly newspaper. And think of how many weekly newspapers are out there now. Like, man, I mean, that print's already a dying thing. So maybe it was a little bit serendipitous that phone call came from Cabela's. But yeah, my wife and I talk about that all the time. Like, we were not even engaged then, we were dating. And I was like, I'm going to do this and whatever. And then a day later, just moved out to Western Nebraska.
That's crazy. Is that where Cabela's is headquartered?
So was prior to the Bass Pro Shops Cabela's merger. Sydney, Nebraska was where Cabela's was founded. Okay. My office where we're at so I'm under the credit card side, the loyalty side, and that's in Lincoln, Nebraska. So I'm on the east side of the state now, which is where I grew up. I grew up in Columbus, which is a small town about an hour and a half northwest of Lincoln.
Cool. So actually worked out to where you didn't even have to, I mean, now at least you're able to be close, like kind of what you talked about when you were with Eastman's.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, it was, my parents are, a little over an hour away, and it's definitely nice to be able to have grandma and grandpa when Samantha and I got to run and do something or whatever. It's just a quick phone call, because that was something that we were missing out in Wyoming. And we only had one kid then. Now we got three with a fourth on the way.
Yep. With a boy, right, coming?
With a boy, yeah. Nice. Finally, yep. Get to drop the whole girl dad thing, traded in for just dad now. So yeah, December, got a first son coming.
Awesome. Hey, December 2nd is always a good day for a boy to be born on. I'm just going to...
I'm just saying, like, December 6th is the day. And if I'm judging anything off my wife right now, we could be December 2nd or sooner.
Nice. So you end up taking that job. And was it, I guess, because a lot of times I think, maybe we grow up as kids and we're like, oh, if I could get that job, like, was it, I guess, maybe kind of everything that you thought it would be when you were doing the hunting? I mean, obviously, I know that it wasn't working out maybe from the distance, but, I've just heard a lot of people that are like, oh, all my life I wanted to do this, and then I actually did it, and it wasn't actually kind of what I'd hoped for.
Yeah. I mean, very candidly, when you're hunting on TV, it is not as fun as it sounds. There's an innate experience that comes with hunting. And when you add a cameraman and other people to it, not only does it make it harder, but it also ups the odds. And the other thing is the pressure that comes with it. The outdoor industry, there's a lot of money being thrown out there from companies, use our boots, our pack, our scope, our gun, our bullets. There's a lot of money. And in order to fulfill those contractual needs, you have to be successful. It added a level of pressure. And I don't want to say that it didn't make hunting fun. Hunting has always been fun, but the pressure that came with it, the pressure to, get the shot and make a good shot, make a clean shot, make sure that the product label is visible and all those things, man, it, you know, it got to a point where, you know, when it's a job, it feels different, you know, and I had a chance at a really, 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 really not exaggerating big bull elk, and didn't get to shoot him because the cameraman couldn't see him. I was drawn back 26 yards, couldn't shoot. And a lot of people I tell that story to, they're like, yeah, I just would have shot him anyways. And it's like, nah, not when it's your job. That's not going to be a fun conversation when you go back and say, hey, I killed a huge Boone and Crockett 380 plus bull, but we didn't get it on film. That's going to be a pretty unfortunate conversation for you.
So one of the stories that I had a friend tell me a while back, who has an elk ranch, cause they had a hunting show done at their place. And like when you were doing it, cause this is something that I always find a little fascinating, is that the people basically never let on that it was on an elk farm, right? Never really let on that there was a fence kind of keeping them in. And it was kind of like, you know, we're sneaking up through the woods and it's like, yeah, but there's a fence like right over there. They're not going anywhere. And obviously not asking to like slander or anything like that, but was like, I'm always curious, like how much made for TV is hunting? Is there a lot of kind of almost like that deceptiveness that goes on in that? Cause it seems like there is.
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak for everybody. I can speak for the people I worked with, you know, when I was at Eastman's, I mean, it was all legit, you know, 100%, you know, their big mantra is 100% public land DIY. And obviously, yeah, there was some private land hunts, but they were very forthcoming about that. There is, to your point though, a lot of deception out there around, what we'd call a game farm or a high fence estate. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's commonplace because I do believe that the majority of the industry is good. But yeah, there's definitely some, not necessarily lying, but not telling the whole truth.
Reality TV at its finest, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the world we live in today, right? I mean, they tell you what you need to know and nothing more. Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it is what it is. You know, there's nothing wrong with high fence hunting. I've been on high fence hunts on the other side of the world. It's very prominent in countries like Europe, New Zealand, Africa. That's very, very prominent. It is what it is. And people understand that. But I think where the problem is, like you saw and your friends saw, was just call a spade. It's no big deal. But the U.S., there is a definite, you know, stigma that comes with Western hunting inside of a fence. I mean, there's some big ranches in Idaho that I know of that, yeah, got really, really big bulls. I mean, huge bulls. They're pretty easy to spot. If you know elk, when you see it in a trophy photo, you're like, yeah, that don't look like a bull that came off the side of a mountain outside of Riggins. you know, for sure, pretty quick. But you know, a lot of people aren't educated on that too. So they just take it at face value and yeah, I killed this bull up in unit 54 in Idaho. And that's all they say. They just leave out the little detail about it that was in a 10-acre pen.
Yeah. So as you were doing some of the hunts, like what was the fun part about it? Like was the production side of it fun? I guess obviously, you know, and we'll kind of move into what you do now in a minute, but kind of going back to the TV side, cause I do think a lot of people are kind of fascinated by how all of that works. Like, was it fun kind of getting all the gear set up and getting the shots and all of that? Or was it just kind of like a drag because it's like, man, I just want to hunt and we're always waiting on this stuff?
I mean, I would tell you that honestly, it was a lot of fun. There's a, you know, a little bit of, I don't want to call it stardom, but you know, as a little kid that grew up watching Monster Bucks VHS tapes and Bob Fulcrott and old Fred Bear videos and things like that. Like, it's like, man, I'm doing this. This is me. It is cool. The fun part for me was I really enjoyed trying to make it as 100% authentic as possible. In the industry, we call it cutaways, right? Where you gotta film real tight, you know, the shell coming out of the gun. That shell's already been shot. But, you know, now you gotta film all the little cutaways to piece it together for the viewer. Because nobody would wanna watch a hunting show in its entirety if you really showed it. You know, there's a reason you gotta cut it down to 23 minutes and allow 7 minutes for commercials. Yeah, there's obviously a lot of cuts you gotta get made, but the part that I enjoyed was just trying to make it as authentic as possible. You know, the holding the binoculars and doing the Captain Morgan point off into the distance, like, we're gonna go over here and all that stuff. Like, it's just so fake and over the top. I tried to be as genuine as possible, and the people I worked with were, you know, the same way. There's a lot of people who do it really, really well, naturally. And there's a lot of people that don't do it well. But, you know, my favorite part was the trying to make it as real as possible, and you know, not having to recreate stuff to basically make it seem like what happened, but it really didn't. You know, and there's a lot of people who do it today that, like I said, do it really, really well, and you can't tell what's been scripted, what's not. But just that documentation style of really just saying over the shoulder, hey, we're gonna go and do this, that was a lot of fun. And the other thing, man, you know, and I'm blessed to do it now, and you know, as many countries and continents I've been to, is the travel. You know, getting to see cultures and meeting people from all over the world. I mean, I think that is the thing that, if I have to say what I'm most fortunate to have done, is see things that many people will go their whole life and never see themselves. I think you become a better educated person about a worldview when you have the opportunity to go travel like that.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so cool to see different cultures and how they view hunting and just that whole process. So did you grow up in Nebraska? I guess I've never hunted out there. Obviously, I know that you guys have some big whitetails from what I've heard, but was there much elk hunting for you there?
No. So, you know, elk hunting really didn't start in Nebraska till the mid 90s. So basically elk migrated out of Wyoming and South Dakota and started coming down to Nebraska. Now we've got a big population. And there's a once in a lifetime tag that you can draw. We don't need to talk about my wife drawing it last year. We can leave that alone.
Or the absolute monster that she got.
Yeah. Thanks, Derek. Appreciate it. But no, we didn't have elk hunting back when I was a kid. You know, primarily deer, whitetails and muleys out west. But a lot of, back then, can't say now, but a lot of pheasants, ducks, geese, turkeys. That was primarily what I grew up hunting, and big game was pretty much limited to deer.
So did she, is it truly like a once in a life? Now she's done. She'll never be able to get another tag.
So we are going to talk about that. Cool. All right. Yes, she drew a once in a lifetime tag. In Nebraska, you can only draw one bull tag your entire life. So like in Idaho, you know, it's a random draw. You could draw many bull tags in your life. But in Nebraska,
if you live here, you can just get one every year.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Nebraska is not that fortunate. It's a once in a lifetime draw. So she drew it last year. I was at work. I about had a heart attack, because there's a little back end way that you can find out before, because they send you an email, you know, like many states do, like, congratulations, or, hey, sorry, you were unsuccessful. Like I've heard for year after year after year after year. And I looked in the back end way and her points were gone. And I'm like, man, like what? And it didn't even say elk zero, like elk was gone. And I'm like, man, does that mean what I think it is? And I called Game and Fish, and she's like, sir, and I talked to this sweet old lady. She's like, sir, I can't tell you that. She's like, you just have to wait till the draw. And I'm like, well, it's not for me. It's for my wife. And she's like, oh, well, that's different. And I'm like, yeah. So like, I don't need you to tell me if she got a tag, but can you confirm that if her points are gone and elk is gone and I see antelope and all this other stuff, does that mean she got a tag? And she goes, what's her name, sir? And I go, Samantha Bender. And she goes, and I hear her clicking away, and she goes, does Hat Creek bull tag sound right? And I'm like, thank you, got to go, bye, click. And I hung up and I flipped out. I screamed in my office. Everybody's like, what's going on? And I'm like, Samantha drew a once in a lifetime elk tag. And I mean, cause in Nebraska, it's a really, really big deal. Like you only get one shot at this. I mean, my wife was 33 years old at the time. She had been applying for a lot of years. So a lot of people naturally, you know, the haters come out and say, oh, they gave it to her because she's a girl and blonde and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, she paid her dues like everybody else. But yeah, drew a bull tag, went out way western Nebraska, basically where Wyoming and South Dakota meet up in the corner by a town called Harrison. Hunted with a kid named Chase Studemeyer, Hat Creek Valley Outfitters, and he put us on a great bull, and opening day that night, we found him, bedded him down in the morning, and went back in that night and called him in, called his whole harem of 18 cows in to 80 yards. And he didn't like that. And my wife got the, she got your quintessential elk hunt. You know, he was bugling, he was raking trees, he was glunking, he was just the whole thing at 80 yards. And she shot him
at 80 yards?
80 yards. I built that custom rifle, you know, that was super accurate. And I was like, okay, you know, whatever distance we see this elk reasonably, I need to get her a gun that will do it, et cetera. And yeah, we end up shooting him at less than 100 yards.
Wow, that's awesome. So I would imagine then if it's a once in a lifetime deal, you probably just put the money out and you get a guide, right? Does everybody do that? I would imagine.
I wouldn't say everybody does, but in Nebraska, I mean, 97% of Nebraska is private land. So, I mean, you do the math. I mean, if 97% of Nebraska is private land, that's going to very limit your odds on public land. I mean, we're not talking Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, where there's hundreds of thousands, millions of acres of private land or public land. Nebraska is 97% privately owned. So it's me personally, yes, I paid the outfitter because what you're paying for is access. And this outfitter had, you know, 30,000 acres to go on. So there, that's a one of the interesting conundrum things about Nebraska. They get a lot of public versus private kind of button heads because they think, well, it's a public resource because the state owns it. And, you know, these license sales pay for the funding and all that stuff. But at the same time, it's like, well, the private landowners, they pay taxes year round on all that land if there's no elk on it or not. So it is an interesting issue. There's a lot of opinions out there about Nebraska elk hunting for sure. But yeah, 100%. I knew that, you know, in working in the outdoor industry and selling hunts and fishing trips for a living, I knew that anybody ever draws it, me, my wife, my dad, my mom, anybody, like we're going with an outfitter right away because it's not necessarily the outfitting is a portion of it, right? You need a place to stay, you need food, but what you're paying for is access and that's what you get.
Well, I think it would be honestly a no-brainer, not just from that, but I mean, there's probably not for you guys, obviously, because you've done it. But I mean, if you're just kind of Joe Blow in Nebraska, that's never been on an elk hunt because you've never been able to hunt.
Right.
The last thing you'd want to do is screw up a once in a lifetime opportunity because you're trying to figure out how to get on some elk.
Correct. And man, you would not believe the stories that you hear, especially on social media, like a lot of these pages that are out there. Guys like, I drew a bull tag, I don't want to spend the money on an outfitter. And then you kind of follow that story year around at the end of the season. It's like, never even seen an elk. Never, you know, I heard a bugle once, blah, 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 but never seen. And it's like, man, I understand it's a lot of money, right? Like we paid good money for this. But at the same time, I know what elk hunts go for. And we paid a fraction of that to do this. You know, the elk hunts that even I sell, you know, $10,000-$15,000, and you're not going to kill as big of a bull as we killed in Nebraska because Nebraska has such big bulls because it's such a small limited number of tags.
Yep. And I know that you talk about a lot of times kind of the glory pose from the big bulls and everything else and you kind of being against that, but what did it score? Just so people understand, because that was a monster.
350 and an eighth.
Dang. Yeah, that was awesome. And I don't think your wife's a very big person. And so I remember seeing the picture of her just looking like all it was horns around her.
Yeah, it was a big boy. You know, and again, back to the hunting industry, you know, numbers and for clarity's sake, I'm not against numbers. But at the end of the day, I think a hunt is a lot more than just the number. But a lot of people, as soon as she killed that bull, were like, what'd it score? It's like, you know, I'll tape it when I'm ready. I mean, I knew what he was before we pulled the trigger. The outfitter and I were on the same page and we were like, yeah, that's probably roughly what he is. We were guessing 345 is what we guessed. And there was a bigger bull that we could have went after. But you know, the experience was more important for my wife. And when we called that bull in and he's raking trees, screaming, and those cows are looking at us, I mean, that's what every elk hunter dreams of. So could we have pulled her off of that and then went over to the other side of the creek where we knew this other bull was and tried to kill him? Yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the day, that wasn't what it was about. I told Sam, I said, hey, if you want to take him, that's a great bull. Absolutely pull the trigger. And I didn't even have to say pull the trigger. It was gone. So.
Oh, how cool. What an experience. It's just so hard for me. And I know that we're spoiled here in Idaho to fathom, like hoping you can get an elk tag, right? Like it's just so foreign to me. I wonder, and maybe you would know this better than me, but like, I worry that'll happen here. It seems like, you know, just the amount of hunters, and they did cut down, I know, the out of state tags that go out, but there is kind of that worry to me that at some point, and again, my scope is a very, very small scope here, just kind of local. It's like, man, there's people everywhere during hunting season from all over the place, not just like from a couple hours north or south of us, but literally like all over the place. And it's like, I wonder how long that's sustainable.
You're spot on, man. You know, this is something that I follow very, very closely due to my job. But if you look at by the numbers, Idaho being one of them, Wyoming was another huge one, New Mexico, the influx of people applying for big game hunting tags since COVID has been absolutely astounding. Is it going to be sustainable? No. There's going to be radical change that's going to come from state agencies. You know what it's going to be? I don't know, but something will change, you know, because it's a big, gigantic, this is a whole different podcast, but you know, the tags are one thing, but look at a town like where you live, you know, what that does to the economy when those hunters come in, the hotels, the bar, the grocery store, all that, the outfitters, the land access, all that stuff. It's a way bigger thing than just tags.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at a really, really interesting time. I mean, if you follow some of the numbers, some of these states were up 20% year over year from how many applications they saw from getting people out hunting. It's going to be really, really interesting to see what's going to happen by the time, you know, your kids and my kids are our age, because I think it will look different. A lot of the Western states, you know, they do the preference points, Idaho not being one of them. But you know, where you have to apply every year to kind of earn a point, and it's a merit system. Think of it that way. But the problem is what's happening in some of these states that do that. It's a phenomenon called point creep. And what that means is when you get a big injection of years, like we've had since COVID, of tons of people applying, and then you've got these people who have been applying the whole time and they're not drawing tags, you have this thing called point creep. So a tag that used to mathematically take you 5 years to draw now takes you 7 or 8. And then by the time it should take you 7 or 8, it's now 10. And you're basically going to chase this tag, but it's because the numbers are so off. And it's a very real thing. States like Colorado have that happening real bad right now, because a couple of years ago, they changed their way that you had to apply. You used to have to apply for a license, buy a $340 license just to put in for a preference point on a deer tag. And then they would refund you the money. You would get like $310 back, and they'd take their money for the point. Then they said, okay, we're done with that. Now you just got to pay $10 and that's it, and apply. So what do you think everybody did? They went like crazy and applied. So then you've got this graph that should be a nice little steady mountain, but now it's just a steady mountain, and then it goes, and then it comes down, and then it goes up again. And that's what point creep comes from.
So crazy. And then, you know, I remember, what's it been, 25 years ago, probably, when they reintroduced the wolves here.
Right.
Right. And I remember my dad talking about it, just being like, you know, obviously for him and cows and stuff like that, it was bad news. But I remember him saying like, you know, these things breed, they spread fast. And he's like, I worry about some of the game and the hunting and everything else that'll go along with that. And I think Colorado just approved wolves, right? And so they have declining numbers. And now you're going to add in basically an apex predator. Like, I can't imagine that that's going to help the problem.
Yeah, it's... having someone who used to live right outside of Yellowstone commenting on this, they have no idea what they signed up for.
Yeah. I talked to a guy the other day, who was actually very fair-minded, because I think these types of issues can get pretty heated, like the wolves. Yep. And stuff like that.
Yep.
And he was very logical about it. And, you know, obviously he comes at it from the herd management and everything else. Obviously you've been around this stuff for most of your life. Like, what are your thoughts on it? I'm not asking to be like pro wolf or anti wolf, but like, for people that are like, oh, it's great for management. Like, what do you think about that? Do you think there's validity to that?
That's a tough question. Without backing me in the corner, what I would say is this: there is a place for apex predators. but they have to be managed. If they do not have any sort of management plan, you are, I mean, this is just the truth. Look at Yellowstone. You can't drive through Yellowstone now and really see but a lot of bison, the occasional elk that hang out around Mammoth, and maybe some black bears. I mean, the days of huge herds of mule deer and moose and things like that are gone in Yellowstone because of the wolves. And I think that it is a touchy issue because I think a lot of people don't understand that when you take out the management, when you take out, call a spade hunting, when you take that out and there's nothing there to keep them in check, well, they're not going to keep themselves in check. Everybody thinks, well, Mother Nature will take its course. No, you're going to end up with no wildlife because wolves don't kill for just food. They kill for fun too. They will go maim a moose calf and never eat it. They will, you know, basically eat out the back end and leave it lay. They'll do the same thing to cattle. They'll do the same thing to sheep and they move on. Sometimes killing multiple times a day because they can. I think there has to be management. What that management plan looks like, you know, I know Idaho has changed theirs. Montana just changed theirs this year to allow some different hunting tactics. Because at the end of the day, what I think they saw, even in Idaho, was like, yeah, you can turn people loose to go hunt them, but you're still never going to make a dent because they're an apex predator and they're smart. And it's not as easy as people think. I think people have a perception of what wolf management looks like versus what it is. And it's just simply not true.
Well, that's like the two things that it comes down to on this topic for me is, number one, it seems like it's almost impossible to get accurate numbers on them, like how many there actually are. Yep. Because they're very efficient breeders. Right. And so I think it's hard for people to understand like how fast they multiply. And then the second side of that is kind of like you mentioned that people don't understand is how hard they are to actually kill them.
Right.
I mean, we're in the mountains all the time here. All the time. And we have wolves, you know, especially kind of down the road at our other section of property, everywhere up there, right? Not everywhere, but we have a lot of them. And you'll hardly ever see them. Like, yep. Hardly ever see them. You'll catch them on game cameras, you know, that way, but you will hardly ever see them. In fact, it was like last winter or the winter before on a game camera I have up here, they had moved in about 5 minutes after our horses were sitting there grazing. Right. And so that was kind of freaky. And we wondered why our horses went down the road, you know, down the way here. And it's like, well, that makes sense. But you know, they're all over and you can never find them. And so depending on the management style of it, it's almost like you need a helicopter and somebody with a really high powered rifle to be able to find them. And I know that the government agencies do that. But then it comes back to the numbers, right? Because they're only doing that stuff if they think that the numbers are getting out of whack. And it's almost like it only becomes a problem when it's a problem, right? Like once they kill six of your cows or something like that, maybe we'll go see what's going on at that point. But it's just such a weird deal that you know, like I see Colorado bringing them back when it's like, don't you guys know what's going to happen in 10 years from now? Like no one's going to be hunting. Right. Like that's what I worry about at least. And maybe that, hey, you know, let's go down this conspiracy route. Right. Like maybe that's the point of it. I don't know.
It's hard, man, because, you know, I think a lot of people just aren't educated and it becomes political.
Yep.
And then nobody wins once politics get brought in. And I think that's what you're seeing in Colorado. Hunters know, you know, those guys who are buying over the counter elk tags, mule deer tags every single year, they know what's coming. It's the same thing that's happened around a lot of those units that are around Yellowstone in Western Wyoming, which is up where I lived. You know, herds just slowly but surely get smaller and smaller and smaller. And then they just vacate the area because they're tired of the pressure from wolves. Bears too, but not near as big of a problem with bears. But, you know, it will be interesting to follow what happens, you know, over the time, by the time our kids are old enough to be our age and maybe have families of their own, it could look staunchly different. I'm lucky enough to have traveled and I've been to places where they have, you know, taken away hunting of certain species in Africa, like elephants. When you go over there and you see how much damage elephants do. Like, I understand the Disney effect. Nobody gets it better than me, right? You can't shoot Dumbo, all that stuff. You know, you're a terrible person. You just want the ivory, all this stuff. Like, don't even get me started, because you don't know. But what they don't fail to see is when that there is no conservation, when there is no management practices, you end up with countries that have the highest rates of poaching that you would ever see. The most wildlife human conflict you'll ever see, because there's no hunters there. There's nobody to keep those herds in check. Those people in Africa who are trying to make a living growing crops have their entire fields, their entire livelihood wiped out in a night when a herd of 10 bull elephants come in there, gone. I mean, just nothing gone. I mean, you have houses that are ruined. You have people that are killed. All that stuff that happens over there can and will happen here. Not exactly wolves killing people, things like that. But what I'm saying is the analogy is the same. If you don't have that, you're going to end up with what the rest of the world has seen when you take away conservation and management practices.
So what do you say? Because this is actually what I wanted to talk with you about. When people are saying, yeah, but you're living in their neighborhood, right? Like you're trying to grow crops where they live. Like, why should they have to die because you want to grow your crops there? Because you want to go play in the park where bears live or mountain lions live.
Yeah. I mean, human wildlife conflict is a very, very real thing. I think what it boils down to is your side of who you agree with. Do you agree with the fact that, you know, man should be able to go out and hunt and catch and cook his own game? Or do you feel that we should succumb to the rights of animals?
You know where I stand on this, so.
Yeah, I figured as much. You and I are probably pretty closely aligned. What I would say is, until you have seen real human wildlife conflict, you don't really get to have an opinion on it, because you're not educated. When you have seen real human wildlife conflict, when it affects your income, when it affects your family's ability to thrive, you quickly have an opinion on it, because you understand the importance of conservation and wildlife management practices.
Well, and the thing that I struggle with in a lot of those instances, when people are like, well, maybe you shouldn't build a house there. Maybe you shouldn't, maybe you should stick to the cities and let the animals stick to where they live or whatever, is that it seems like, and this may be an overgeneralization, but it seems like most of those people actually don't spend any time in the wildlife. And yep. So they just don't know. Like, they don't see, you know, like with a wolf when it rips out the asshole of a deer. And literally that's all it does. And there's guts hanging out. And, you know, you see a fawn like sitting there dying, like tortured, because a wolf thought it would be fun to go and rip it up open like that. Right. Or when you go and you find one of your calves, you know, from your cows, you know, completely demolished, or, you know, I've told the story, I think, before on here, but my dad had three of his cow dogs just absolutely slaughtered in about 10 seconds. He was riding through the woods, whatever you want to call it, up in the mountains. And, you know, dogs take, like cow dogs, they take off after squirrels and stuff all the time. You don't think too, you know, anything of it. And he was telling me the story. This has probably been, I don't know, 10 years ago at least. And he was riding like through the woods, and all of a sudden all the dogs took off. It's been, again, you don't think anything of it. He said, you know, a minute or two later, he heard some yelping. He said, he took off on his horse. He was riding his horse, you know, and he took off on his horse over there. He said it couldn't have taken him 2 minutes to get over there. He said, by the time he got there, he said there was a radius of blood about 30 feet around. He said the cow dogs were just absolutely torn apart, and the wolves had already been gone by the time he got there. Yep. And it's like, I don't think most people understand like how actually like vicious those animals are. And they just look so pretty though on TV. Right. And that's really the only context that you have when these discussions come up.
Yep. And you know, I think education is key. And what side of the fence you're on, I think really depends on whether or not you have real world experience with it, because you can't trust what you see on, you know, social media or, you know, the news or a documentary on the BBC, right? Because it's the Disney effect. Everybody wants to show the wolves coming out of the, or the pups coming out of the den, and they're looking so cute. Everybody loves that. I mean, even hunters love that.
Yep.
But nobody loves what your dad saw. So then people will come and they'll say, well, that's Mother Nature. And it's like, okay, let's go down that path for a second. So they do that to your dad's dogs. and then they go to the next rancher's dogs, and then the next rancher's dogs, and then their livestock. And where do you draw the line between saying, man, this ain't right. I got to be able to do something to keep this in check. Like, everybody thinks that hunters are just out to kill, 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 kill. That's not the case. We play a vital role in conservation. And the only way to protect wildlife is to conserve it. If you take all that stuff out, all those measures out, there won't be wildlife left. You won't have the Disney effect in Africa. You won't have animals that roam Yellowstone and Glacier and things like that. These parks will be desolate because there won't be any type of management practice in place to keep those herds in check. I mean, it's just, and you know, you can, and it's so hard because it's like oftentimes talking to a brick wall. Like, their line is drawn in the sand.
Just like anything that's controversial, right? It's just all walls against each other.
100%. You know, they're right, you're wrong. You're not going to convince them otherwise, right? I mean, where have we heard this before? That's society today.
Yeah.
But I think if those people had real life experience like you and I, they have been out there. They have seen those things. They've seen the effects. You quickly, like you said, you know, real quickly, you're like, I know where I stand on this because you know. And I think that real world experience is the best teacher.
Well, and the way that I look at it too, is that if the argument is ever used of, well, that's wildlife, right? Like wildlife, there's predators and there's prey. It's like, okay, great. Let's further that. Then I'm the predator now. I just happen to carry a gun, right? Like, right. If we want to go full just evolutionary side of this, then it's like, hey, we've evolved to the point to where we can build big guns and get traps. So I guess now I'm the apex predator, right? Like, you know, if you want to go down to the grassroots of it. Yep. So, and one more thing on this real quick that I think maybe people don't realize is even here in Idaho, like where we live, at least elk aren't necessarily native here, but they've spread here. And I think a lot of that, and I could be out of line and I'd love somebody to fact check me on this out there if they know for sure, but I wanted to ask you, which is, so from my understanding in history is that like pre-1960s here, there was really no elk in our area. They migrated here after that. And now obviously there's lots of elk here. And I know that also there wasn't as many predators, AKA wolves, at that point. Have you noticed like growth where wolves aren't maybe, or lack of growth where they are, like anything like that from maybe what you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some truth to the fact that animals do adapt over time. Like go back even further, go back 1800s, 1700s. There were no elk in the mountains.
Yeah, they were all plains animals, right?
Elk were a plains animals.
Yeah.
Elk were in Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, South Dakota, North Dakota. That's where all the elk were. They moved to the mountains to seek refuge. That's a lot. People are mind blown when they learn that out. It's like that. Fact checkers listening, you can fact check all you want. It's 100% truth. There was no elk in the mountains. So I think that obviously over time they learn to adapt and get away from obviously humans and predators. And the naturally humans and predators are both going to follow. That's why you see so many more elk out west now. It's where elk are, because there's way more people on the plains now. They are inhabited. There's fences, cattle operations, etc. When all of that, when westward expansion happened, that changed the, you know, the hierarchy of how animals lived. It changed migration routes and ducks and geese. It's a pretty interesting phenomenon if you really study the history of how America got its game herds where they are. And I do think that, yeah, wolves play. I mean, look, they're people, and I know, and I'm not a conspiracy guy, but I know people who've seen wolves in Colorado prior to them saying, I've seen wolves in Colorado. Before Colorado finally came out and said, okay, yeah, we've got wolves here, I knew people that had pictures, that had cell phone videos, etc. Well, you know, then there's all the guys, oh, they dropped them off and all that stuff. No, they came right down out of Wyoming. Yep. And, you know, they started up in western Wyoming and moved their way down across the, you know, the sage flats and the deserts. And basically, you know, they're up in the bighorns, et cetera. They're all over. They adapt over time. They follow the food. You know, it's a interesting phenomenon with mountain lions too. Mountain lions are now being discovered down in Iowa, Missouri, Arkansas. Well, all they're doing is following the river. We have mountain lions in Nebraska all over. Well, they're just following the food. And you look at the river system in Nebraska between, you know, between South Dakota and Nebraska, you've got a huge river. Those cats can move 20, 30 miles a day, easy. And, it was last summer, had a mountain lion get killed in Omaha, our biggest city in Nebraska, right in the middle of town. And it's everybody, you know, comes out and they're like, well, how did this happen? Whatever. It's like, it's evolution. Those they're following the food and they're trying to find a mate. That's what it is. That's what drives animals to survive, is reproduction and food. That's it.
What's wild to me about like the migration and now I remember when the first time, so a guy who used to work on the ranch for my great grandpa, older guy, him saying like, yeah, I remember as a kid, you never saw elk here. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, I remember. I think the first one, I can't remember. I want to say that he's like, yeah, the first one that was ever shot on this ranch wasn't until like 1967 or you know, somewhere in the 60s, if I remember right, 64, 67. And I was like, what? Like there was no elk here? Because now, I mean, there's elk everywhere here. And like how fast they move on these mountains, you know, because you've been out this way, you know how steep it is. Like I couldn't even imagine them being like a plains animal because I never see them in flat areas. They're always on the side of a mountain hauling ass across here, you know, like, and they're just so fascinating to watch in the mountains because of how good their footing is. And so I remember him telling me that. And it was almost like you were saying, when some people learn they were a plains animal, I was just like absolutely shocked because it's like, no, like big buffalo are plains animal, not these elk that fly across these mountains. Like you would think they've been here forever, but it hasn't always been that way.
Right. It was I mean, you look at a lot of the Western history books. I'm a big, big Western history guy. So I love, you know, cowboys, Indians, wildless folklore, et cetera. And you look at people talking about elk hunting, you know, in Nebraska and Kansas, and you're just like, what? Like, you know, I go outside and I drive to work, you know, I'm driving past cornfields and bean fields all day. But again, it didn't always look like that. I mean, it was nothing but prairies and rolling hills. And that was where elk herds thrived.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I know we got to kind of start wrapping up here, but you've been able to go like to so many places around the world, and you're talking about like maybe some of the elephant damage. Like what's maybe something that people would be surprised to know about some of the hunts that you do? Is there anything that's like, you know, like when I first did this type of hunt, or I first went here, maybe it's a different country or something. Like what's something that maybe, yeah, people would be curious to know about on some of the experiences that you had?
Yeah. I mean, boy, this would be a really long answer, but I'm going to be cognizant of time. Once you get outside of what I call Western hunting, which Western is, you know, kind of United States. So we are Westernized, you know, this is Western civilization. The biggest staunch difference that I think I appreciate from my job and my career that I've worked in the outdoor industry now for 14 years, is what you see in Europe, in Africa, in New Zealand, and all these other countries where hunting, they've been hunting way longer than we have here. The tradition and the culture is something that you can't even appreciate until you go see it yourself. A hunt that really changed my life was 2015 when I went to Austria for the first time. And that was the Swarovski experience, the Swarovski binoculars. And we were hunting chamois up in the Austrian Alps. I mean, like straight up Sound of Music, those mountains that jut up out of the earth, and they're so steep. But just seeing, you know, what's called a Jäger, that's where Jägermeister gets its name. A Jäger, a professional hunter, seeing them wearing, you know, deer skin lederhosen with knee-high wool socks, you know, their traditional hunting hat, you know, a cigarette hanging out of both sides of his mouth. He's got his walking stick that is literally a stick off of a branch off of a tree. And then there's me, right? All the technical hunting gear that you could ever imagine. I got $1,000 worth of camo, a $500 backpack, a couple $1,000 gun, and all that stuff. And there, I just looked at this guy and I'm like, man, like, that's what it's about. He has access to the same stuff I could buy, but he chooses to do that to honor the timeless tradition that is hunting. The biggest thing people don't understand about the hunting industry is that it is so different across the world. But one thing that the states, and this is to tie back into what you said earlier about score, you know, over here, it's all about inches and how big is it? Over there, it's all about age, because to them, that animal survived longer on the mountain. They want to kill the oldest animal possible, not only to benefit the herd, but as a feather in their cap, as you know, this animal avoided predators for longer than any other. It's a completely different, you know, way we look at it, because we look at an old elk or an old deer over here and he's all, you know, doesn't have as many points, doesn't have as many inches, and he's less desirable. Over there, that's the most desirable trophy. Same thing in Africa. They want to get the oldest animal out of the herd, not only for conservation practices, but also because that is what is special to them. And then, you know, the other thing I see with what I would want to tell people is, like, I'll never forget when I was in Africa and I walked up on my first poached rhino. Absolutely one of the most gut-wrenching experiences of my life. Because to know what that animal went through and suffered through to just have its horn, which is made of keratin, your fingernail, that's all a rhino horn is, grows about an inch per year. To know that and hearing that professional hunter explain the details of how, you know, a rhino is poached, I mean, it completely changed my worldview on poaching and why conservation has to happen and why dollars from hunters are more than just to, you know, you throw out this term trophy hunting, right? And it's more than just heads on a wall and, you know, racks everywhere, all that stuff. They don't understand what that money actually goes to. You know, COVID has had a really, really big increase in poaching across Africa. And that's because nobody's traveling there to help fund the anti-poaching. So when a hunter goes to Africa in certain areas, and part of that money that they're paying is going towards anti-poaching. And anti-poaching is people with boots on the ground making sure that poachers don't come in and kill those animals. Here's a little stat for you. When a rhino is poached in Africa, the poacher is low man on the totem pole. He goes in, does all the dirty work, and cuts that horn off, usually when that rhino is still alive the entire time. It is not dead. By the time that rhino horn hits Beijing, that's where a lot of the rhino poaching syndicates come from, because rhino horn is considered an aphrodisiac in their culture. That one rhino horn is worth $1 million to $1.5 million.
Wow.
And that poacher is getting the equivalent of $100 in the US. But $100 to them is life-changing. So now you can see this interesting paradigm, right? Like, I could have $100. That could feed my family for a year. So now you see wildlife conflict, desperate, need to make ends meet. If I can just sneak into this national park and kill a rhino where there's no anti-poaching efforts, who's going to be there to protect them? And that's where it's a big, big, big issue that a lot of people only see this one segment. They see the one segment of the guy posing with his elephant. They don't understand the environmental impact. They don't understand the economical impact, because nobody wants to talk about those. They just want to focus on the guy and what he did. They don't want to focus on that animal and the several thousand pounds of meat are going to go to the entire village and feed hundreds of mouths. When you go see a meat drop in Africa, I know you've seen photos that I've posted and things like that, but we take so much for granted, man. And I know you and I are aligned on this with understanding where our food comes from and things like that. But when you go see people, hundreds of people line up for just a fistful of meat, and that is going to be the only source of protein that they get, that only comes from hunting. When you go see people, kids, you know, fighting over a pile of bones and scraps, whatever, because that's what they're going to use to sustain themselves. When you and I can drive uptown to the grocery store, pay some money, buy it out, gone, it's in our, you know, skillet 10 minutes later at home. Once I started traveling, all of these things that I had no idea were really all connected, were actually connected. It was a game changer, man. And that's why I feel so passionately about conservation today, and why I want, you know, your kids and my kids to be able to have the same opportunities that you and I did. Because if there's not going to be people that have this stance that you and I do, it's all going to be gone. It's already happening in other places of the world, but, you know, it's turn a blind eye, right? Because Africa is just, you know, it's Disney, it's lions and tigers and bears and all that stuff, right? But if we don't do something, and you sit on your hands and you take this stance of, nope, I don't want to hear it, whatever. It ain't going to be there very long.
Well, the thing that always gets me is that we are so blessed and fortunate to live in a place and in a time to where we can choose to be vegan, or we can choose to be, you know, on the South Beach diet, or you know what I mean? Like sometimes when I see people are like, oh, they're murdering these animals in Africa. And it's like, these people are literally starving to death. They are doing anything they can just to get until tomorrow. Like while you're grabbing your mocha choco latte, whatever, right? Like they're just trying to figure out like how to live until tomorrow. So the last thing that you should do is tell them like what they should be eating, right? Like it's just so like arrogant to me that it drives me nuts.
It's just like you said, those people that have that opinion about the way you should run your ranch and stuff like that. Yeah. They've never left Boise. You know, they've never left the confines of the city. And that for me, once I started traveling internationally and you know, especially as a father having kids, you know, that's why I take these photos, because I want my kids to appreciate all that they have. And I want my kids to understand that there is kids just like them on the other side of the world that don't have a closet full of clothes. They have the clothes on their back and that's it. It's such a hard thing for people to put in perspective because they see it on TV and they see it, but they take it for granted because it's not real.
Yep.
When you see it with your own eyes and you see a starving kid and you give them a bottle of water or you give them a toy, like every time we travel, we always pack soccer balls and cleats, you know, because football is the world sport. To watch their faces light up, you know, they have a soccer ball made out of twine and yarn and trash that they wrap up, and that's what they use as a soccer ball. So when you do that stuff, you understand that, man, this is way bigger than just hunting. You know, this is something that you can't even begin to explain to someone until they come see it themselves. And that's why I love photography, because I think that I'm going to take pictures so I can show people like you, so you can show your kids, so you can say, look what this guy just seen over in Africa, because then it becomes real. They're like, I know him and he went and did this. Mm-hmm. That's what I think the power of photography is so important, because it brings to life things that people know are out there, but they don't really want to admit. And when you see that stuff firsthand, man, it's a real game changer.
I bet. I can only imagine. So have you ever had anything like super funny happen out there on a hunt, like, or something? You're just like, what in the hell is that?
Yep. Man, that would be a long, long list. I've had people lose passports in other countries. That's not necessarily funny. That's scary. I've had guys not pack enough ammo, literally ran out of bullets in the field. And when I'm like, well, where's your pack? And he says to me, no, that's all I brought. And it's like, well, now we got a problem. We have no more bullets and we're out here hunting. Yeah, I mean, I've had all sorts of crazy stuff. Had people fall out of boats fighting fish. You know, when you're hooked up to a fighting belt. Again, these are scary things, but they become funny. But yeah, you see it all when you do what we do and you travel all around the world taking people hunting, fishing. You know, it's not about us, me and my team. What we do is we take these people on these adventures. We act as hosts. So think of it as like a VIP concierge service. We're there to help you what to pack, what to expect, get you all prepped, answer all the questions, all that stuff. And then we go with you to make sure that all those things that we said would happen, happen. And that's really, it's a unique, right? Because it's not necessarily gun or rod and reel in our hand. It's in our client's hand. But when you get to be a part of, that's why I tell people, like, I got the greatest job in the world, not because of what I do, it's who I get to do it with. You know, when you take a guy who's 70 years old and he's never killed a bull elk or he's never caught a sailfish, when you get to be there for that moment and you get to be a part of their memory forever, and especially when you get to carry a camera and document it, man, it's special, because it's not about you, it's about them. But the fact that you were the person who made all this happen, it's very, very rewarding.
I bet. Well, and that kind of ties in. I know we got to wrap up here, but obviously we've got to hear kind of about like your lifestyle, the way that everything's been going, kind of like maybe the mindset that got you to where you are at this point within your career and everything else. I guess you know, and obviously you're still a young guy, but as you've gone through this process, do you ever wonder, like, you know, what do you want your legacy to be when this is all maybe wrapped up?
What a way to end it. Man, I want my legacy, I guess, to be that I was somebody who went out and not only talked the talk, but walked the walk, and who made promises to people and kept those promises. I think in a time where you can hide behind a keyboard and your cell phone and things like that, I want to be known as somebody who said he was going to go out and do this and then went and did it. And that's especially in my career when it comes to conservation. When you've seen some of the things that I have, it really becomes real. And you have a perspective that other people don't because they haven't seen it. And that's I want to be known as a person who tried to make a difference, who tried to tell people, like, hey, this is what we need to do, and here's why. Because I've got the real world experience to back it up. It's not somebody who just, you know, studied online and got an article and, you know, that famous thing we see today on Facebook arguments and Instagram arguments. Well, where's your source? Where's your link? You know, I am the source. I am the link. I've seen it. I've been there. I've done that. And I think that the world needs more people like that, you know, like yourself and what you and your wife are doing with your company, which I think is fantastic. The world needs more people who are willing to roll up their sleeves and actually go do it and not just talk about it. And I think that if there's something I want to be known for, it's that. And obviously, as you said, and I appreciate, you know, I'm a family man. I love my family more than anything. And I just hope that someday my kids grow up to be proud of the person that I was, and the things that I did are not as important. As I look at my house, you know, and I know you can't see it, but all the taxidermy and all that stuff, right? I mean, these are all memories to me, that hopefully my kids will learn and appreciate someday, because they obviously all hunt and fish with me now. And I hope that, you know, we have memories to cherish as a family outdoors, just like my mom, my dad, my brother, we did growing up. I think it's a lifestyle, right? And yeah, I think that's, never had somebody ask me that, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, and you're doing it, man. That's the awesome part. So where can people find you? I know probably what, most active on Instagram, right?
Yeah, yep, at Adam J. Bender.
At Adam J. Bender. If, excuse me, if they want to look into the hunting stuff, maybe into a package, something like that, where do they go to find you there?
Yeah. So our website is www.clubsignatureevents.com. And you have to be a Cabela's or Bass Pro Shops credit card holder to go on all of our trips. But a lot of people have that card. So you go there, you can click on adventures and experiences, and you can see all the stuff that my team does all over the world.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Adam, for coming on, man. We'll have to do this again. I feel like we could have definitely gone for probably a couple hours, so we'll definitely have to do it again.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate it and hope you and the family be well.
I absolutely love having you as a listener of the Primal King podcast. If you don't want to miss out on the great content, then it's time to hit that subscribe button right now. Do not be left behind. And then share your thoughts and feedback with a written review of the show. I read every single one of these, and it helps me make sure I am serving you best. It also allows others to find this content, and it builds this community. Make it an awesome day, and we'll see you next time.